The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. Now, regular listeners of the program, The Time of Monsters, will know that we usually focus on very dire news. I'm GT of the Nation, and you know, we cover this horrible era of rising authoritarianism and war. But sometimes it's good to like have at least a little bit, you know, positive or more positive news in terms of more hopeful developments in this era when everything is in flux. And I think, like, for many listeners, one of the positive developments of the last year has been the election of Zoran Mamdani as mayor of New York. And now the nation, which has a long history with Mamdani, once rejected him as an intern, but then subsequently endorsed his mayoral candidacy, and now has a regular city hall reporter. And this is a period where, like, some of our competitors, like the New York Times, have been cutting back on their coverage of municipal politics. But we have former Nation editor Don Gutenplan is covering the City Hall beat in a weekly column. And I think it's been a sort of fascinating document, which I would encourage everyone to be reading regularly, because it sort of is trying to track the how Zoran Mamdani has been doing as mayor on a week-by-week basis, with an eye towards the balance between his sort of expansive democratic socialist hopes and the pragmatic reality of being a big city mayor. So first of all, Don, welcome to the program.
Well, Gene, it's great to be back with you and always good to talk to you.
Yeah. So let's get started on the on your column in general. Like, what's your thinking in terms of, because I don't think we've had a City Hall column in the Nation for a while.
I don't think the Nation has ever had a City Hall column. And I say that as the author of the Nation's history. But the Mamdani beat, which is the name of the column, and which if your listeners want to look for it, they'll have to look for it on Google, because if you put Mamdani beat into the Nation search engine, nothing turns up. So use a better search engine than the internal search engine on the Nation.
Yeah, and actually, what I would recommend is using a search engine, put Don Gutenplan and Nation, and then it will go to your page, and then you get all the columns in a nice consecutive order.
Well, we've got this rubric, the Mamdani beat, so that's nice. And then there's a nice little graphic. For those of us who remember the Beatles, it's a little bit retro, but I like it. Anyway, so what am I trying to do and why am I doing this? Because when I resigned as editor of The Nation in July, I did not have it in mind to do this. But then in July, it looked far from certain that Mamdani was going to be the mayor. And what I realized, along with probably a few other people, is that in a time of monsters, in a time of extremely bad news politically, this represented something unique, you know, a chance to at least spend a little time on the sunny side of the street. And at the same time, this is not my first City Hall rodeo. I covered the last Ed Koch budget for the Village Voice in 1987. And I was a member of the City Hall press corps for the first year of the Dinkins administration in 1990. So there's been a little bit of time elapsed since I had a desk in room 9, but everybody there has been, which is the room 9, by the way, for far flung listeners, is the City Hall press room. And when you walk into City Hall, and this is, I suppose, guidance for tourists, if you go to Lower Manhattan and you get off the subway at City Hall, you'll see this enormous neoclassical building with a tremendous statue of civic virtue on the top in gold. That is not City Hall. That is the municipal building, or One Center Street, which is where most of the city's offices are. City Hall itself is a relatively small federal 1820s white building in a park. It's very beautiful. And if you walk into the lobby, you turn to the left, you're in the mayor's half of City Hall, where the mayor has his offices. If you go straight up the very grand staircase, you're at the council chamber, where the city council meets. And if you turn to the right, you're in the council half. But right before you get to the council half, right off the lobby, is a room full of seedy looking people sitting at desks with laptop computers. And that is room 9, which has from time immemorial been the press room at City Hall.
Actually, before we proceed, since you do have a history of like covering City Hall off and on, I'm a bit curious about the sort of like press culture, because I think, you know, like we were talking about the Ed Koch era, like there was a robust municipal press at that point, you know, like the Village Voice, obviously, but then, you know, like the sort of storied era of the New York Daily News and the New York Post. And I think at that point, the New York Times seemed to be more committed to municipal coverage than I think it has been more recently. So like, any sense of like how the sort of a press culture covering the city has changed?
Sure. I could, you know, I could drone on about this for a long time, but the short version is that in the 90s, there were actually two press rooms at City Hall, or maybe three. There was a wire room where the sort of people from the Associated Press and UPI, you know, would file their breaking stories, and a radio room where, you know, the reporter from WNYC, but also WABC, WCBS, you know, WINS, all the radio news stations at the time would file from. And then there was also a room downstairs, the overflow room, where the kind of second string reporters for the various outlets would have their desks. That was where I had my desk as a young correspondent for New York Newsday. At the time, the New York Times bureau chief was Todd Purdom, who went on to some fame covering the Clinton White House and now writes for Vanity Fair from the West Coast. And the dean of the City Hall Press Corps in those days was the person who I realize is kind of my patron saint. And that's a woman called Andy Logan, who was the New Yorker's City Hall correspondent and would write a column. I don't know. I mean, in those days, the only way you could read The New Yorker was to buy it in print. But her column was called Around City Hall. And she would write a kind of witty summary of whatever had struck her as interesting that week. And she'd been there when I got there in 1990. She'd already been there for 25 years. And she, you know, knew everything and had a vast institutional memory and was also a fantastic writer. So, you know, she's kind of my hero. In the current incarnation, we've been reduced to one room. So the premises have shrunk, or I suppose the city council and mayoral bureaucracy has expanded. And also, when I was there in the 90s, you would have a computer terminal that was, you know, wired to your home bureau. Now it seems like it's interesting. City Hall does not provide Wi-Fi access. There's no public Wi-Fi network that you can use, but, and maybe I shouldn't admit this on the air, we're all freeloading off of Rupert Murdoch because the New York Post has Wi-Fi and they're very generous with the password.
Oh, okay. Well, that's the best thing I've ever heard about the Murdoch press.
So, you know, when you're reading my dispatches in The Nation, be sure to tip your hat in the direction of Rupert Murdoch, okay, wherever he is. But yeah, I mean, you know, like there's a lot more going on. Mm-hmm. The nature of the media has changed a lot. So, for example, AM New York, which, you know, didn't exist in my first incarnation at City Hall and which probably a lot of Nation listeners and readers will have never heard of, they have three desks there. The City, which is, of course, run by our former executive editor, Richard Kim. Their correspondent, Katie Honan, is probably the kind of most knowledgeable reporter from the daily press there. And, you know, and she doesn't write for newspapers. She writes for a website. So in that sense, it's changed a lot. But, you know, the Times and the Daily News are still there. WPIX, although no longer owned by the Daily News, the TV station still has somebody there. It partly depends on when you go. I mean, if you go on a day that the mayor is having a City Hall press conference, then the place is full and you've got to get there early to get a seat. Not at the press conferences, but at room 9 to file afterwards if you're still trying to file quickly. But
yeah, I don't think, because that's one of the reasons I wanted to ask, because I mean, it does seem like, even though, you know, we're in an era where media is struggling more, there's a lot of like interest in Mamdani's mayorship. I think international interest.
I mean, well, I think that's
like,
true.
I've noticed that people here in Canada, in the NDP, are sort of echoing his sort of affordability language. And I've seen the same thing in the European Bloc. So it just seems like a lot of people are very invested in, like, you know, this project and seeing how successful or unsuccessful
it's
going to turn out to be.
That's why I'm there, because because there's international interest in the nation, although it would be wonderful if there was, but because I think there's a lot riding on his mayoralty. A lot of people on the left, and I include myself in this number, have a lot invested in the notion that you can have, if not socialism, certainly social democracy in one city. And, you know, we have this example in New York. There are two bits of history that I think are worth at least mentioning. One is, of course, LaGuardia, the greatest mayor in the city in the history of New York, and who was also a socialist and who governed as a social democrat and who pioneered many of the things that New Yorkers still take for granted and take pride in, including, you know, like a robust municipal hospital system and the city university system. And the idea that the city could provide a dignified life for all its inhabitants was the LaGuardia ideal. And, you know, in some ways, we've been falling off ever since. So there's something hugely exciting about a mayor who wants to not only restore that, but advance it. So there's that. And then, and this is a more obscure episode, but, you know, we're not afraid of obscurity here at The Nation. Paul Blanchard, who was a Nation assistant editor in the 20s, wrote a book with Norman Thomas in 1928, who was the Socialist Party's standard bearer, candidate for president. And the book was called What's the Matter with New York? And it was a kind of a socialist autopsy of Tammany Hall, Jimmy Walker, and political corruption in New York City, and then a series of socialist prescriptions to fix it. It's, of course, out of print, and copies are hard to find. I used to have one in my office at The Nation, and now I have it here in my study at home. But when LaGuardia was elected, he appointed Blanchard one of his deputy mayors. And so, you know, there was a direct Nation line to policy, and there was a direct effort in LaGuardia's day to put socialist ideals into practice at the municipal level. So it's not that it's never been done. It's just that it hasn't been done for nearly 100 years.
Yeah, no, it's true. It hasn't been done in a while. And outside of New York, I mean, I think the areas where democratic socialism has been most successful in the United States has been at the municipal level.
Right.
And sometimes at the gubernatorial level. But I mean, certainly at the municipal level, there's been a lot of far-reaching reforms that the socialist movement introduced. So now I think one of the interesting things about your column, and I think in all good writing, you always have to have a kind of tension within it, an argument that the writer is having within his or her own mind about a subject. And I think that, like, in all your columns, you're kind of like wrestling with both the you know, pragmatic question, how is he doing, but also how is he balancing these kind of like aspirations of social democracy with the sort of practical realities of New York. It might be useful if we run through like a few cases where he sort of made either compromises that are either good or bad or successful or unsuccessful. And so I think one thing that's maybe highly pertinent, because the war in Iran is still going on, and I think will be going on for the foreseeable future, because there's no clear off-ramp. I mean, one of the things that Mamdani did that surprised people is that he, has had two visits to the White House that have tried to, like, open up a bridge or a dialogue with a president who's, like, not just a Republican, but, like, a virulently right-wing Republican, especially hostile to socialism. So what are your thoughts on, like...
On the Mamdani Trump unlikely?
Yeah.
There are a couple of thoughts. And as you pointed out, you know, I think I'm still kind of wrestling with it in my own mind, because it's certainly true that the first visit to the White House, which, you know, was not announced and where the two of them, you know, emerged kind of wreathed in smiles. And then there was that wonderful clip on social media of Mamdani being asked whether he would still describe Trump as a fascist. And you know, his good manners and instincts for candor were struggling with each other. And the president put him out of his misery by saying, "It's okay, just say yes." I thought that was a brilliant piece of political theater. I thought it was a very wise move. Now, why was it a wise move? Not because he was sucking up to the president, because he wasn't explicitly sucking up to the president. He didn't agree with anything, you know, that he wouldn't have agreed with in another setting. They are both New Yorkers. And also, you know, for us hardcore materialists here, it's worth pointing out that to the extent that Trump owns any assets that are worth anything, the most valuable ones are in New York City. So, you know, if New York City was transformed from the capitalist paradise of the Bloomberg era to the smoking ruins of sort of John Carpenter's hellscape, that would be bad for the Trump family business. And so...
And it's, you know, beyond that, I mean, there's a materialist aspect, but I mean, Trump has a real consciousness of himself as a New Yorker. And, you know, his sort of self-understanding is that, you know, New York was in the pits of the 70s, and then he was part of the revival of, you know, who still had faith in the city and, you know, were willing to build in the city. So, I mean, there's something, a component of Trump of like, you know, build back better in New York, if nowhere else.
Yeah. No, I mean, Trump's, you know, there's a lot to be said about Trump's relationship with the city, both in terms of mythos. You know, he sees himself as a quintessential New Yorker and as a New York character. And of course, he succeeded in the one industry. I mean, New York has two real industries. One is real estate and the other is public relations. And he may not have really succeeded in real estate, but he certainly made it big in public relations. But it's also true that whatever success he had in real estate, you know, and this is a topic for another day and a deeper dive, but came in large part because of his family connections to New York's governing political establishment and the favors he was able to leverage out of them, which got him started as a builder. So he's always had an eye on New York City politics. He's always had an investment, not just emotionally, but in terms of actual capital, in terms of in who's running the city at a given moment and how they relate to the family business. And of course, you know, the president can do an enormous amount to, now I'm trying to avoid the seven words, but one of the word I'm avoiding is followed by up. So the president can do an enormous amount to blank up a mayor of any city, as poor Jacob Fry could testify at great length.
Yeah, and it has. I mean, Trump has actually like specifically gone after Democratic cities and done a lot of damage in Los Angeles, Chicago, you know, certainly Minnesota.
So, you know, if you're the mayor of New York, you kind of have to ask yourself, well, I mean, you have to ask yourself, I think, if you're prudent, two questions. One is, why hasn't he done it here? And two is, what will I do if he does? And, you know, I'm hoping that there are wise heads in City Hall who have gamed out the second scenario. And my personal guess for the answer to why he hasn't in New York is what I said before, which is that he has interests in New York which go beyond government. And, you know, if you had 50,000 angry New Yorkers with torches at the base of Trump Tower, it would be bad for Trump. So, you know, he may not particularly be eager to pick a fight with Mayor Mamdani or New York City, but that doesn't mean that the mayor should be a jerk about provoking him. And so in going to Washington the first time and coming away the way he had, I could see that he had every reason to consider that a success and that his advisors were pleased with what they'd pulled off. I suppose one of the tensions that I'm alert to in the column is, as it were, between PR and governing, or between the campaign and administration. And the temptation to go for another easy win, which was clearly going on, you know, they printed up that fake Daily News front page, Trump to city, you know, let's build.
Yes. Oh, along with the real...
with the real Ford to city drop dead. Yeah, the real, you know, to give Trump a flattering contrast with a previous Republican president. Well, you know, that might have seemed like a clever idea at the time. It certainly got the kind of press coverage they wanted. On the other hand, some of those smiles must have curdled the next, you know, this was a Thursday. By Saturday morning, when American weaponry is, you know, killing schoolgirls in Tehran, cozying up to Trump looks less good, and it looks less like a good idea.
Well, I mean, yeah, no, there's obviously a danger in terms of sort of, you know, giving any sort of bear hug or association with Trump. I would say, like, in his sort of defense, like, was there like an actual material benefit that he got out of it, which was that Department, I believe it was the ICE or Homeland Security, had gone after some students at Columbia, and Mamdani was able to get at least one of them released.
He got this poor woman who was arrested and, well, abducted, really. But anyway, yeah. Was in federal custody. He did get her released. That's good. That might have happened anyway, or maybe it didn't. There was she was abducted that morning. So,
yeah.
You know, it was kind of like it would have really looked bad if he hadn't raised her case. And of course, it was it was an easy boon for the king to grant his liege. But the theoretical purpose of the trip was to get, which was to get Trump's backing for this project in Sunnyside Yards, which is a massive railroad yard in Queens, where they're going to have to build a platform over the rails, much like Hudson Yards, and then build housing.
Yeah.
That's a plan that the de Blasio administration had gotten as far as blueprint stage, and then it had stalled. And yes, if Trump had decided to fund it, that would have been helpful. He didn't. He merely smiled about it. And of course, the same political conflicts which stalled it in the de Blasio administration have resurfaced. So, you know, in that sense, it was...
Yeah, you know, I know that there's less of a clear-cut win. I think really the thinking behind both meetings, though, and this goes back to sort of Mamdani's own origin stories, in terms of running for mayor, is he had interviewed a lot of people who had both voted for Trump and AOC. And he did a video about this. And the idea is that there's a significant segment of the population that is just concerned about like affordability and economics and don't neatly map onto a left-right spectrum. And to the extent that Trump can be made aware that, you know, this is actually part of his political base, it would act as a constraining factor on him on the one hand, and it would also allow Democrats to have a bridge to win back those people who are open to AOC or Trump and went for Trump rather than Kamala Harris. So I think the political logic of these meetings with Trump seemed to be less about Trump than about, like, you know, trying to gain a legitimacy among those voters who had put their trust in Trump and who now might be open to an argument. Well, you know, he hasn't actually done the sort of, you know, affordability stuff that he promised, but that agenda is still there.
I would buy that if they didn't try and do that by producing these flattering, you know, media spectacles. In other words, it's one thing to say there are people who voted for Trump because they wanted change. Hillary and Kamala were continuity candidates. Trump was a change candidate. But unlike Trump, who didn't deliver on the promise of bringing more affordability, I am going to. But you can't do that while flattering the guy. So I'm afraid I don't buy that argument.
Well, I mean, maybe the other way to think about it is, like, the flattery works both ways. I think one of the things that Mamdani has to, like, contend with is that he's seen as, you know, a threatening or alien force, but, it is particularly portrayed that way by the sort of hostile right-wing media, like, you know, Fox News and the New York Post. But, I mean, to the extent that, like, Trump is shown basically in the two meetings, particularly the first one, but, like, even the second one, as, you know, like, basically treating Mamdani as a legitimate politician, as someone who has, you know, some ideas that Trump, even if he doesn't follow through, is at least amenable to, or, you know, thinks, you know, in the abstract are good ideas. Like, there's a, you know, I mean, the danger is if the danger is you're legitimizing Trump, the upside is that you're also legitimizing Mamdani.
Yeah, no, I hear you, but I just think it works both ways. I guess I think that if you go to Trump as a validator, then you're validating him.
Yeah. He's won the presidency twice. So he just validated that you could be in the American political system, right?
Yeah, but anyway, I mean, you know, like I said, if it weren't for the war, it wouldn't maybe, I mean, it wouldn't look as bad as I think it, I think it was a miscalculation. Yeah. But, you know, others may feel otherwise.
Yeah, no. I think in some ways, some of these same issues show up in another issue, which you wrote a column about, which is his relationship with Jessica Tisch. So do you want to talk about, first of all, explain who she is, and then...
Yeah, this is really fascinating, and I kind of stumbled into this. So I don't want to shock our listeners, but The Nation does not pay me enough to go to City Hall every day, 5 days a week. So I go to City Hall on the days that I think there'll be something of interest. And sometimes I go elsewhere. And so I went one morning, I think it was a Friday a few weeks ago, to the mayor's prayer breakfast, which was at the New York Public Library. And, you know, that was interesting. And it was interesting to see the city's first Muslim mayor presiding over what is normally a relatively Christian forward gathering with a few rabbis thrown in, you know, as tokens of goodwill. This was a much broader base of religions than usually are represented on the podium at these occasions. Mamdani was very eloquent and very welcoming. But then after that, I went to what's called the NYPD Foundation, which is a, you know, one of these things that we have in New York, even though it's the richest city and the richest country in the history of the world, we don't have enough municipal funds to do a lot of the things that New Yorkers would like to do, particularly wealthy New Yorkers. So they set up foundations where they can give directly to support causes like keeping Central Park manicured or keeping the 42nd Street Library in tip-top condition, or in this case, giving the police department even more money than they can get from the city budget. So this is more like, you know, not defund the police, or, you know, this is like extra fund the police. And that's this group. And yeah. Tisch was speaking. And so who is Jessica Tisch? She is someone who, there are two very important things to know about her. One is that she is a member of the Tisch family, who her grandfather founded the Lowe's Corporation that owns hotels and movie theaters and, you know, it's a $10 billion, Forbes estimates the family's net worth in excess of $10 billion. So, you know, it's a kind of New York version, if you like, of the Pritzkers. And they are Jews. Her cousin is, or until last week, when his name showed up more than it should have in the Epstein files, was the CEO of the New York Giants. You know, and it's a big diversified family holding company. I think some of the money originally came from tobacco, but anyway, it's very diversified. And so that's one thing to know about her. The other thing to know about her is that she has been a public servant for about two decades, and for the bulk of that actually worked for the police department in its kind of data management division, where she was an innovator in the use and implementation of various data collection and data management strategies. And then she was named IT commissioner by de Blasio, or no, by, I think maybe it was even Bloomberg. Anyway, she had a commissioner level appointment, and then de Blasio made her sanitation commissioner. And she was very successful managing the sanitation department under de Blasio. And then Adams, who was in the process of going through three police commissioners, one because he undercut her authority, another because he was the subject of a federal corruption investigation, and the third, for reasons that are still a little obscure, he picked Tish and made her police commissioner. And she turned out to be a very canny choice, both because she had spent a lot of her career in the department and in its data division. So she was, as they say, across all the NYPD data in a way that any other incoming commissioner would not have been. And because she's a very competent administrator. You know, she does not seem, like Franklin Roosevelt, to be a traitor to her class. She has not gone on record as favoring taxing the rich, or she was not an early booster of Mamdani. On the other hand, when he won the nomination and it became likely that he was going to become mayor, she had a series of meetings which were reportedly organized by Catherine Wilde, who was then the head of the New York City Partnership, which is the kind of big business lobbying group in the city. And she and the mayor, you know, got to know each other, and he was pressured fairly heavily by the governor, but also by various business interests, to say he would keep her on. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are a number of constituencies in New York that were mistrustful of Mamdani at the time. One, of course, is the general run of the city's Jewish community, who were mistrustful of a pro-Palestinian Muslim. But he had also been very much a defund the police guy in 2020, and he'd had to walk that back during the campaign. But of course, talk is cheap, whereas choosing to keep Tish on as commissioner was a gesture that the people who care about public safety in New York and who do not want to defund the police took seriously. So, you know, there was a way in which they entered into this relationship. He's her boss. Mm-hmm. At least nominally. And I say that because, as I say in the column, last week or 2 weeks ago, there was a snowball fight in Washington Square Park in which several police officers ended up getting pelted with snowballs. Depending on your point of view of these things, it was a young people's stunt that got out of hand, or it was lawlessness run wild. Anyway, the mayor said he thought it looked like a snowball fight. The commissioner said it looked like criminal and, you know, terrible behavior. And they arrested two of the people who threw snowballs at the cops. Now, if he's her boss, why did they arrest these people? Obviously, because he decided he wasn't going to fight over this. But also because she wanted to send a message to the public and to her officers that, you know, she has their back and that disrespect to the police will not be tolerated. So, you know, there are inherent tensions in their relationship, irrespective of their very different class and political positions.
The one thing I'm curious about is, like, in terms of actually being able to implement any sort of policy, I mean, like, one sort of practical, you know, we won't say defund the police because that's, you know, now not politically correct. But one way, a thing that I think Mamdani is still committed to is moving some of the police services away from the police to social workers, like, you know, like in issues of like dealing with people who have mental health issues or even like some domestic disturbances. Now, is he good? Would he be able to implement that with someone like Tish?
Well, that's the $64,000 question, Jeet. I mean, I will note, and we are in March, for people who are keeping score, the city budget is not due, the final budget is not due until July. No real substantive action will happen until the state passes its budget, at which point we will find out whether the Senate and the Assembly versions, which were both passed last week, both of which called for tax increases on the wealthiest New Yorkers and corporations, get their way, or whether the governor, who has said she's against such a measure, gets her way. So, you know, that has yet to finalize itself. And even if it does, then the city council and the mayor have to decide what they're going to do about the state budget and how they're going to, as they say, plug the gap in revenues between whatever the city wants to spend and what the state has promised to provide and what existing city revenues would provide. So all of that has yet to play out. But with that caveat, it's worth noting that the Department of Public Safety, which is the new department under which the mayor has proposed to shift responses to 911 calls that are not about crime. So, you know, whether it's an emotionally disturbed person or a domestic dispute or somebody having a psychotic break in public, which sadly happens, you know, with great regularity in New York City, that's not in the budget yet. There are no funds allocated for that. So it may be that he's going to do it, but he's not going to do it this year. It may be that he's never going to do it, but he certainly hasn't announced that he's doing it and this is what we're going to spend on it yet. And when he does, you know, part of the question will be, well, is that, let's say, for the sake of argument, $1 billion going to come out of the police department's existing funds, or are they going to be totally new funds? Because the point of this department is, I mean, I'll give you an instance from this morning. I was on the subway this morning going down to City Hall, and there was a man and woman on my subway car who were having a very large, loud domestic dispute. Mm-hmm. And they were yelling at each other, and she was getting desperate and he was getting angry. And it was clear that they weren't really listening. They were just winding each other up. And it was also clear that this would have been a great time to have somebody from a non-weapons carrying city department available. On the other hand, speaking only for myself, it didn't reach the point where you would risk calling the cops and having either of these people shot, which is what happened just last week when some family called the police department because their son was having a psychotic break and their son ended up being killed by the police. So, you know, it's like the need for this is clear, and doing this would theoretically take some of the workload off the NYPD, but the path to getting there is far from clear, and the mayor has not yet even set out a roadmap for how he proposes to get there.
Yeah, no, I mean, it does seem like the, this might be the sort of like note to end on, but I mean, like, it does seem like the budget is where like a lot of these issues are going to be sort of like playing out. And like, if you have any like thoughts on that as a sort of like concluding note in terms of how to measure Mamdani's success or his ability to achieve his agenda, is it still like fairly opaque in terms of like the budgeting, or we have any sort of clues?
I would say it's worse than opaque. I mean, I would say two things. First of all, you know, in terms of the Ed Koch question, how's he doing? I would say the mayor at this point is still deserving of an A-. You know, he's terrific at the kind of signaling and symbolic part of being the mayor, which in a media capital like New York is an important part of the job. I'll give you a small example. 2 weeks ago, I think before the war in Iran began, the mayor posted a picture on his Instagram account of breaking the fast, the Ramadan fast, yeah. And he was eating a humantashen, which is a three-cornered sweet pastry that Jews eat at Purim. And it was just such a brilliant piece of semiology, because it was like, you know, yes, I'm a Muslim mayor, and yes, I'm doing this thing with my fellow Muslims, and yes, I know that for some Jews this is going to make you feel excluded, but I see you, and you know, and I'm still thinking of you even when I'm doing this. And I just thought, you know, he's just a brilliant communicator of inclusiveness. And, you know, that's not a small thing. And it was something that, for example, Eric Adams was terrible at. Yeah. But the budget is where you're going to find out what they're serious about. Yeah. And sadly, the mayor has allowed himself to be decoyed into this puppet show over the deficit, which has gotten a lot of headlines, but which veteran budget watchers don't take seriously. Yeah. In other words, yes, there is a deficit. No, it is not new. You know, Brad Lander warned about it when he was still controller. We knew it was coming. and you don't actually have to raise taxes to solve it. And in any case, proposing to raise taxes to solve a budget deficit is not something that's going to mobilize the masses to go into the streets for you. If you said to people, you know, we're going to restore free tuition to CUNY, and we'll do that because we've put a 1% surcharge on the incomes of New Yorkers earning more than $2 million a year, that would be pretty popular. In other words, if you pointed to services that you will only be able to provide if you can raise taxes on the wealthy, great. But to say we need to raise taxes on the wealthy to take care of Eric Adams's bad bookkeeping, it just doesn't seem serious.
No, that's more a Walter Mondale message than a
exactly than a Bernie Sanders one. Yeah,
I think Mondale is the last Democratic presidential candidate to run on deficit reduction through tax cuts, through tax raising taxes.
Yeah,
but in any case, but I mean. Certainly, the story is going to continue to unfold, and I would encourage listeners to read Don's column in The Nation, I'm Downey Veet, and we'll continue to see how this very eventful story that many of us are invested in, how it plays out. Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much. Thanks, Jeet.
Craving the coffee flavor you love, but without the caffeine? Cachava's got you covered with their newest coffee flavor. This all-in-one nutrition shake delivers bold, authentic flavor crafted from premium decaffeinated Brazilian beans with 25 grams of protein, 6 grams of fiber, greens, and so much more. Treat yourself to the flavor and nutrition your body craves. Go to cachava.com and use code NEWS. New customers get 15% off their first order. That's K-A-C-H-A-V-A.com, code NEWS.